This is the Out of Time Film Podcast, where your hosts, Tom and John, discuss everything from blockbuster films to TV and games like there's no tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the Out of Time Film Podcast. I'm Tom.
I'm John.
And this week we're talking about The Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim.
It's funny that we're getting so many Lord of the Rings projects. We got a Gollum project. I think we mentioned about these in the last Rings of Power. But this is a completely different format. It's an anime and it's a pretty cool direction. It was produced by Warner Brothers and it's pretty interesting for this year for anime. And it's pretty nice to go into something that's medieval and it's Lord of the Rings, which is two of the coolest things combined together with anime and Lord of the Rings. And I can see loads of influences into here, like Vinland Saga, Berserk. It's really cool to see it.
Yeah, it's not our first time that we've seen a Western franchise be translated into anime. We had Terminator Zero just a couple of months ago. And I think it's a really interesting way to do this. Obviously, this film takes a lot of inspiration from the iconography of the films. It has the same location, some of the same characters. Miranda Otto reprises her role as Eowyn and narrates the entire film. There are various references as well, and we will get into all of that, but it is translated. We are 200 years before The Hobbit, which is about 270 years before Lord of the Rings. We're in Rohan, and we're following Helm Hammerhand, who we do hear about in Lord of the Rings, but we now get to see him fully, and his daughter Hera, and an early battle for the throne of Rohan. You can definitely see this film takes lines from The Two Towers, especially, and Return of the King, about the role of women in Rohan in this medieval world. Mm. As Eowyn says, the women of this country learned long ago that those without swords can still die upon them. And, you know, she talks about wanting to fight even though she is encouraged against it. And obviously we see the climax of that in Return of the King and even some deleted stuff in Two Towers as well. That feels like the inception of this story is kind of taking that back, being like, okay, this would have been entrenched for quite a long time in Rohan's history, but obviously the Shield Maidens did exist. So how does that work? That's a really interesting way to jump off this project, I think.
Yeah, that moment in Return of the King. Yeah, you know, when she kills the... Man, there's so many names. I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. That moment specifically was awesome. And I think a great inspiration to like the role for women in Lord of the Rings and how they have an impact for the story. And I think that's what the story does in here with Hera. It's a pretty good step in a way of looking to the different perspectives of Middle Earth. Rings of Power did it pretty cool as well, looking to Galadriel. And it's about, you know, taking leadership as well with Hera in the story and trying to learn from her father. And I think with Lord of the Rings, it's about taking action. You know, you're trying to fight for your future, and you know, you get to really see that with Frodo and Sam.
Yeah, and it was nice for this one to have lower stakes. Obviously, the stake of Rohan the Kingdom is very much what the film is concerned with, but it's not about the entirety of Middle Earth. It's not about the entire race of men or the entire race of elves or hobbits or whatever. It's just this series of characters and the people surrounding them and how they're going to be affected by the movements in the narrative. And I appreciated that we focused down a little bit more. But having said that, there is a lot going on in this film, and I think it could do with a little bit more of a sense of direction and a bit more focus, because, you know, we are establishing a lot of characters in this new period. I mean, other than Helm Hammerhand, we haven't really heard of any of these people. And the film definitely throws a lot at you, and across its 2 hours and 15 minutes, it does a lot of world building about this particular time period, and it introduces a lot. That means the film is kind of darting around quite a bit, and I was very conscious of that fact, that we're not doing this over the course of 3 films, we're not doing it over the course of a series of television. This is it, this is what we've got. And I definitely did struggle with this one in terms of truly becoming invested in the characters.
I agree, the film was definitely trying to show the time period for Rohan, but it struggled to explore the characters on an emotional level, really, like with the emotional intelligence of the film. I mean, there is that relationship between Hera and her father Helm, but the problem for this film is that we don't really get to see Hera that developed as a character. I mean, again, the film is very low stakes. There isn't a lot of tension in this as well, but it is interesting how there is some layer of conflict. But then again, it's not that complex, especially the villain of the story. It's just a one-dimensional villain. The main villain for the story, Wolf, he has a scar on his eye.
It's such a silly...
Oh, like, they look evil. It's like, that's yeah, it. It's they like, just look evil.
How do we make this guy, you know, Wolf evil. Is our villain, and it's like he's called Wolf and he has long dark hair and he dresses in black and he's got the scar, and he's arguably our secondary character that we spend the most time with. And when you think about it, Lord of the Rings is really interesting in terms of its villains, because who have you got? You've got Sauron, who never shows up, isn't even a villain. You've got Saruman, of course, who is barely in the books but is much expanded upon in the films. You got your odd orc Uruk-hai here and there. In The Hobbit, again, it's just Smaug, but the film expands on that as well, with Azog and with the Master of Lake Town, etc. so forth. There's not a whole host of villains in this series.
Gollum?
Yeah, Gollum, I guess. Yeah, yeah, he's kind of, in some semblance, a villain. A very tragic one as well. But in terms of those core antagonists, it's not like the kind of cornerstone of this universe. I don't know. I felt like the film had some really interesting elements with its protagonists, but when it came to the antagonist, I was just kind of disappointed. We are introduced to Wolf when his father brings him forth to ask for Hera's hand in marriage. And there's this kind of idea within the film that he is hurt by the fact that she rejected him. And there's a kind of interaction where he's like, is it that disgusting to you to be with me that you would rather die, or that you would rather sacrifice other people? And I found that really interesting, this idea that he was forced into this by his father and has kind of been twisted by low self-esteem. That would be a really compelling thing to explore. But instead, we just get this kind of half-assed plot about revenge and him wanting to take his rightful place. Very Scar from The Lion King. That's what I said to you when we left the cinema. And it's like, yeah, but he doesn't have nearly the same maniacal motivations. I know we're getting Mufasa the Lion King literally next week, which is going to give Scar a tragic backstory or whatever it's going to do. But the reason why I love that villain and many other villains is because you really feel in their characters that they're evil, and that evil kind of consumes them. Saruman is another example if you want to use Lord of the Rings. But this one, it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, there was something that was building about this idea that he is afraid. He goes to war to fight his fears. He's just terrified of losing power. And I thought that's an interesting inner conflict to explore, but again, it's not explored greatly. And I just wish that his motivations would be clearer as well. And there was something else that I want to see as well. It's just like the conflict between Hera and Wolf more. It was so interesting at the beginning, but then it just got lost in the film. It just went somewhere. So I wish there was something to explore more of that. I thought that was so intriguing to see that he was so upset that he got rejected by her, but then he just became like, I'm so angry.
I want the throne. Yeah.
I want the throne. I want my Dune, my Arrakis.
I mean, that's an interesting comparison, isn't it? Like, those characters work so well because they are so evil and you love watching them be evil. You're making an interesting point about the start of the film, and I think it's interesting when you look at all the Middle-earth stories, keeping it on screen here for the sake of keeping it streamlined, but Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, Rings of Power, the thing that they all need to get right is the beginning. If you don't believe in the hobbits and the Shire or the Harfoots or the elves or the dwarves or men, any of these kind of different factions, if you don't believe in them and the light in their life and the things they're fighting for, the film just kind of falls apart. And I think that this film didn't quite get that start for me, even in The Hobbit. And I think this film is better than the second two Hobbit films. But the first Hobbit does such a good job at setting up the stakes that when you hit the less good films, it doesn't matter, because the first film has made you invested, at least in my experience. This film, it wasn't until maybe the third act that I was kind of getting into the investment of it. And like, yeah, in the flow. That's a long time. Like, I think surely we should be establishing that a little bit further. I mean, hell, if you want to make this film longer, go for it. And if that's what it needs, you know, the Lord of the Rings films, even if it is the theatrical, they are not short films. But you need to get that beginning. And I feel this film kind of struggled there. And maybe the film could have had a bit of a slower start so we could kind of build those characters, of which there are also too many characters.
Yeah, too many characters. Yeah.
And I don't know how close to the lore this is, but you know, in The Hobbit, when you've got 13 dwarves, and it's like, well, in the books, there's 13 dwarves, so in the movie, there must be 30. It's like, well, maybe you could kind of cut it down a little bit so we're not dealing with so many. It's in this one, it's like, the too many characters and too many of them die, and it's like, hey, wait, so who was that? It's just a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's something to consider when it comes to making things from a source of when it comes to adapting works. And with 13 dwarves, that's a good point to talk about. Like, how do you focus on so many characters, whereas the book can do that? A book can explore those characters. But in a film, that is very overwhelming. That's important to consider about how do you make your film a bit more accessible with the characters and thinking about how to communicate the theme towards them in different ways. I think, yeah, with the characters, it was too many to like think about what the goals were. You know, it just felt like we didn't have time to think about what are they as a character in this world.
Yeah, and a lot of the film felt like there weren't many moments of levity. Not as in like, sure, I need a comedic scene or anything, but it didn't feel as time to breathe, really. And even in the music, you feel that. This uses various themes from Lord of the Rings, from Howard Shore's work, and that stuff's all impeccable. It's untouchable. But what the original score does is you don't really feel like there's ever a moment where the score properly slows down and does something tender. It's like in Lord of the Rings, whenever the Shire theme comes up, you think of a peaceful time, you think of something green, something beautiful. You never get that in this. And I accept that it's going for a different tone completely, but I just kind of felt like it was throwing a lot at me the whole time, which is a shame because like the film, the animation is pretty good. And basically the whole second half is in winter during a blizzard. And I really enjoyed exploring Middle Earth in that kind of climate. Other than the Pass of Khadras, we don't really see that in the films. It's great to see the icy landscape and the snow going through. That was really great. It would have been great if we'd have explored that a little bit more. I think because we already know Rohan from Two Towers, from Return of the King, we know Edoras, Helm's Deep, the filmmakers kind of just assumed that we could just drop us straight into it rather than giving a bit more time to establish it. But I think it's the opposite. I think it's important to establish these things rather than just be like, boom, we're in.
Yeah, they have this expectation to know everything. It's just set in that world. And then I think what the movie also struggled with was just to preface, I loved the idea of the Shield Maidens, right? Yeah, the Shield Maidens and how Hera looks up to them and has this strong resemblance in a way. And I thought that was a great motivation for her. But the mythologies that I thought was a bit lacking was the king himself. Should we get into spoilers?
Let's do it, yeah.
Yeah. So out of nowhere, the king is just some crazy berserker guy, and he's too angry to die. In the second half, he somehow survives all the arrow attacks that you got injured from. And the film doesn't really explain about how he has so much power, in the sense of like, how can you go through this in the middle of the winter? I mean, there was a bit of foreshadowing, which I just remembered, where he punched or he killed Wolf's father.
Single punch. Just bosh.
It's One Punch Man.
Is it actually a prequel to One Punch Man?
Oh, a prequel for One Punch Man. He does one punch a day rather than 100 push-ups. So again, it was just loads of things were just lacking, and just like, how does he have that power? There's a lot of unanswered questions. What do you think of that? King becomes a berserker.
Well, first of all, I want to say Brian Cox plays Helm and does a great job. The cast in this film is
brilliant.
All awesome. Brilliant
job.
You know, there's not really much I can fault this film on a technical level. The acting was great. The animation was great. All that stuff. The bit where he kind of goes all berserker genuinely was the bit where I perked up and where I started going, hold on, what?
Interesting.
What is this? Because I was so confused. I didn't think it was him at first. I thought, no, he's bedridden. He's just been shot with a bunch of arrows. He's recovering and
I cannot move.
I was like, is this a wizard? Could it be Saruman, perhaps? Ooh. And then we find out, no, this is Helm, and he's there wearing pretty much just a vest in this blizzard and just knocking people out, and he goes toe-to-toe with this mountain troll as well. And it was just so crazy, and so like, even when he dies, he freezes to death in a powerful like position with his hand held aloft.
It reminded me of a particular moment in One Piece, which which I cannot spoil because it's a great moment. It just reminded me of that.
Right.
But yeah. Well, yeah.
Maybe that was their inspiration. Again, I don't know if this was in any of Tolkien's texts, maybe somewhere in various appendices, but they decided to make this guy the coolest dude ever and just make him for no reason an unstoppable hulking being who clearly, you know.
I didn't mind it, but I just wish there was some, you know, kind of explanation.
Yeah, no, it came out of absolutely nowhere. And then they just kind of move on. And it's like, okay, a little bit of mystery, a little bit of magic. I get that. Sure, man. I think it's a shame because I think he is really well characterized. Even though you don't understand some of his kind of motivations, but then his sons die so fast and without any proper exploration. And then Hera herself, they could really use some more. It's difficult because so much of it is almost there. I feel like we've been harping on about the stuff that didn't work, but it is worth saying that, yeah, a lot of it is there. You can see Hera as a very intuitive character, somebody who's brave and somebody who wants to fight. There's a lot of echoes of Eowyn in there. That's all really interesting with her and her cousin as well, who eventually becomes the king. And then there's an old shield maiden as well who helps out, and a lot of these interesting characters. Also this idea of like hope and the symbol of Helm Hammerhand, the cousin who becomes the king, literally wears the armor as this kind of beacon and it scares the army, and that stuff was all really cool. I thought the third act of this film was where it really came alive, and it's a shame because I just thought that the first two acts were struggling.
Yeah, it just had nothing to build upon with the characters. It just felt like, okay, there you go. And the third act, I mean, it had some emotional level to it, but just didn't really go deeper. I mean, it was good to see Hera and Wolf duke it out, but again, I wish it was something to reflect on with them between their conflict. It just felt so rushed at the end. It's just like, there's got to be something that it needed to build on.
Yeah, there's a motif kind of going throughout of the eagles who are kind of flying around.
Eagles! Oh my god, it's the eagles!
Yeah. Again, every on-screen Middle-earth film is just like, hey
it's
guys, the eagles.
Yeah.
And it just kind of was like, again? Really? Like, is this really the solution to our problems all the time? And I thought to myself, wouldn't it be really interesting if this was actually a part of Hera's arc? She does have an arc. It's an arc of accepting her leadership and finding her way to bravery, but that very much is her being allowed a chance to lead by other people. And I felt like maybe personally she could have had a chance to grapple with the eagles, and maybe she's scared of them at the beginning, but she has to overcome her fear. I don't know, but she just kind of comes to the eagles and she's like, hey dude, I need your help. And the eagles are like, sure thing, off we go. And, you know, the fact that they're always there is kind of hilarious, and it feeds the ongoing joke of, yeah, just ask the eagles for help whenever they need it.
Yeah, do you know that question about, like, there was that one fan who asked Tolkien, why wouldn't the eagles take them to Mordor?
I didn't know anyone ever asked him that. What did he say?
I think he said, shut up.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think
I love that. Yeah, Tolkien's like, shut up, mate.
Yeah, shut up or something.
Yeah.
I think it's somewhere, or either I'm just going insane.
I can't imagine anyone ever asked him that, but if he did, that is hilarious.
It does feel like a plot point that I could put a hold, just like,
for
oh,
sure.
Why couldn't they fly over there?
I feel like on screen, at least, every time we've seen the eagles, it becomes more and more convenient. Like, in Lord of the Rings, it's beautiful, it's fantastic, it makes a lot of sense. In The Hobbit, it's obviously, I know it's in the book, but again, strictly talking about in the films, they come back and it's like, oh yeah, the hot, yep, from Lord of the Rings, and then they come back at the end of Battle of Five Armies, and it's like, wow, okay, they really just solved the conflict. And they're in this film again, and it's like, sorry, do they have a day job? Like, what are they doing? It's waiting for humans.
Do you think they just fly any minor inconveniences if you just dropped the ring or something, and they just like, and they just swoop in and just help you, and that's it?
Maybe. Just, I mean, they took the meat at the beginning, so, you know, that meant something. The final thing I want to talk about is the references to the wider Lord of the Rings. As I said, it's all the same locations and kind of iconography, and that stuff's all fine. It makes a lot of sense then to do that for this film. But at the end, there are three moments when it's just like, right, okay. There is a really interesting moment where we see two orcs in the middle of the film collecting rings, and they're kind of saying, well, what does Mordor want with rings? Very, very interesting. Small bit of world building. You know, I thought that was just kind of like hinting at other things that are out there. That to me was really fascinating. But then there was this moment at the end when Hera was like, this place is going to be called Helm's Deep. And then, she, you know, it's like she turns to the camera and winks because it's like, sorry, did we need that? Did we need that moment where they just turn to the camera?
I was about
like,
to, like, you know, that meme with like the pointing thing, like, oh my God,
yeah.
Helm's Deep. Oh my God, it's there.
Yeah. And then they do it again with Saruman when Saruman's like, hello, it's me, Saruman. And my entire beard is white now. And it's like, right, sure. Okay, here he is. I guess Isengard, it was to rent, and he went to the estate agents and he was like, hey, is this tower that is shaped exactly like my staff? Can I? And then the final one, right at the very end, Hera's like, there's this wizard who wants to know about the rings. What's his name? He has many names, but in the common tongue, he's known as Gandalf. Like, turn to the camera, properly grab the camera by the lens and just say Gandalf. It's like, guys,
I wonder who that could be.
I've never heard of such a thing.
The Stranger?
Mithrandir?
Gary?
Gary? Gary Dalf? I'm honestly just did we need those three things? I don't think so.
No,
who knows if there will be a sequel to this. I don't think it's going to do very well. It hasn't been very well marketed. People aren't talking about it. I just think this is, you know, Sonic 3 is out next week. Mufasa's out next week. It's going to completely go under the radar, which is a bit of a shame because it does open the door for some really interesting stories from Middle Earth with this art form, even though this film itself was, you know, fine. But did we really need that kind of baited moment where it was like, oh my god, Saruman, is that Christopher Lee? Who knows?
I hope it wasn't AI generated though.
I hope it was archival footage or an impersonator or something, because
archival, yeah,
that would be so upsetting.
So what
are you gonna give the War of the Rohirrim out of 10?
A 5.
I'm gonna give it a 5 as well. I generally don't think I'll ever watch this film ever again.
Me too. I'm just like,
That's it. If they make a sequel, I might give it a rewatch, but it is a bit of a shame.
Maybe.
Yeah, but yes, thank you everybody for listening. If you're listening on YouTube and you enjoyed it, you can like and subscribe if you want to see more. And if you're listening on Apple or Spotify, you can follow and give us a 5-star review if you think we're worthy. And next week, we got to do something bad before we do something good. Next week is Kraven the Hunter. I'm so sorry. But the week after that is Sonic. I promise it's coming. I promise we're going to be free.
Next week, peak yes. is incoming, everybody.
But first of all, we have to do the final Spum film.
No, dude, it's just the final one that we just need to get through. And you can follow us on Instagram at the Time Field Pod to see our incredible thumbnails from Zane Asville, on Twitter for more thoughts from me and Tom, and TikTok to see edited clips, which are all also on Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts. And you can find links to that all in the description below. Thanks to L. James Mayer for the excellent theme and Ronan Phillips vocals as always. And I think that's everything.
Amazing. The Zoom call is about to end, so... Bye.
Take me in.
Give nothing back.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
It is going to end, isn't it?